lovely to be here. Always great to be in Cork. We talked about it earlier, and I have many great memories of here and association with the place. But I'm originally from Leitrim, a very different landscape altogether, and probably a lot of the poems I'll read tonight are out of that place, out of that landscape and language and people. I think I'll, for the most part, let them speak for themselves and not say too much about them. After the American Wake, it is 1904 or 1905. We don't know the time of year, but it's likely summer. Two men are saying goodbye forever at a green gate over a stream. They are both called Miles, both are tall and thin. One is going to America and will never return. One is staying here and will never leave. They have watched the dawn rise over the loch, seen the last of the stragglers home. They hear the jingle of the horse's harness, linger, clasp hands, hear the driver shout, "Remember," said the one leaving, "remember tonight." Where I grew up is very close to Origna, on the Roscommon-Leitrim border, where there have been coal mines for probably about 200-250 years. Initially very rough and ready, and later a little bit less rough and ready, and they were working mines up to the early 1990s. And I made a radio documentary last year about a strike in those mines in 1968-69, so in a way half a lifetime ago. But years ago my mother had told me a story going back to the famine, and then later another neighbour, a wonderful man, Paddy Murray, told me almost exactly the same story separately, and I realised that it had come down and didn't doubt that it was true. And the voice in this is very much the voice of Paddy, who was a miner himself, and it's really his narrative. Famine Pit. We travel backwards down the mountain from a pit of screams. A miner is running in the mist, his brown bag flopping, his helmet clutched under his arm. We race with him through the July evening, panting, through the thin white air, down the bleak rock, lungs pumping, across the bog, eardrums deafened to the dazzle of the lake. Then stop to quell heartburst, to rest hands to ears, the scream still there but fainter, fading, till at 70 and dying he tells the story. I heard it as a truth, not much talked about, but remembered. It was the truth, it happened, but I didn't know that till I broke through. A widow with three children went it again. She had a son with her new man, who married into the place, 30 acres. Then the hunger came. One day when she was away in the town, I think she was selling eggs or butter, he took the three children, her three, and brought them up the mountain. He told them they were going to the bog. They brought the black dog and the donkey. "We'll be home," he said, "before your mother." The sun was shining. They stopped on the bog for bilberries, then carried on up the rock, on up the mountain to the pits. The old shafts were holes in the ground, straight, deep down. I wonder how he done it. Did he say, "Look in," or motion to something else, something distant, to distract them? Anyway, he threw them in the pit, the boy, the two girls, and the dog. They'd have broken their bones, but I suppose they must have lived for weeks after. He walked back with the donkey and brought home a load of turf. It was said he told his wife the children ran away when his back was turned, and she never asked more about them. Some had it one of the girls got frightened before they reached the pit and ran off. She stayed with her father's people and went to America when she was 15. I never gave it that much heed. It was a story like any other. But when I was 32, I broke through the timbers of the old mine. It was boarded up since that time. It was a July evening, about 7. I stood in the dark for a minute. Then it started. The screaming, the crying, the barking of the dog. Child's voices talking Irish. The hair stood on my head. Then I ran. I ran down the mountain. Soon I'd be dead, but all this happened. It's the truth. Tell it. And I suppose that, you know, there's always this questioning in whatever we write and whatever we consider of what is the truth and what, how we invent truth or how we remember, and we can only sometimes witness and tell what we know, and that's something that came home to me very much last year when I was making that program about this strike in the coal mines in Arigna. And at the time I was just a lad of about 8, 9, and my uncle was the main strike leader, and my godfather was one of the men, he was a foreman who continued to work. And all around us there were people who were divided. About 12 men went back to work from the community and were scabs, and some of them were beaten up. And it was this awful crevice in a small place, in this small community. And I suppose, you know, I carried that with me. My father had worked in the mines when I was a lad, my oldest brother worked there briefly, and all around us there were people who went off on a rattling on a bus, on a lorry, in an open back lorry every morning, to go down into these incredibly primitive conditions and rattle back at 4:30 in the evening and go off and do a day's work on the farm after. And all of that, I suppose, had this really deep impact. And before I made that program about the strike, I started writing about the mines. And these are some of the poems. What's in a name? The owners called it the mine. The workers called it the pit. A miner laments his boss's death. He was dying himself when he heard the news. Fitzgerald was dead. Lung cancer, they reckoned, from the players. Frank raised his head. Damn me, he said, but I outlived him. And for all the hymns that'll be sung, I'll have a bigger crowd at my funeral, and we both got dust on the lung. Coal makes rubber. My grandmother would say, well, wasn't he so kind, Mr. Fitzgerald, to stop for me in his motor car, stop to give me a lift, even open the door and help me with the shop. Ah, Frank would snort, I won't waste me breath on a curse. So well he might stop for you, so well he might stop. Wasn't it ourselves put the rubber under his arse? Looking back, you couldn't wait to be 14 to go down the pit. You got your first long trousers, helmet, pit lamp, bread and bit. There was no knowing then that in 40 years you'd be good for nothing, lungs gone, hardly fit to eat. Prohogue. Time was everyone had their own prohogue. That was an odd hole of the ground where they knew there was a bit of fire stuff and they probed away at it. A couple of neighbours would say at the back end of the year, before the snow came, we go up and we buckle up some fire stuff for the winter. It was mostly column we used, and do you know why? No man had the price of coal. And column was the, you know, cheapest version of coal, not much more than dust. And people used it in the area to make these column balls, which were like a primitive form of briquettes, mixed with daub and water, and they shaped them in to a kind of briquette called column balls, and that process of making them was called dancing the column. No music, only rhythm and words in your head as you tramp the slack. Poverty riding on misery's back. Poverty riding on misery's back. Poverty riding on misery's back. A brother remembers a small act of defiance. He met the owner on the way in. He was late. They glowered at each other. 20 past, 20 past, said the boss. Is that a fact? said the brother. He was first out at the end of the shift. You were early, said the boss, not smiling a bit. Tell me this, me good man, and tell me no more. What's the meaning of it? The meaning of what, said me boy, pure innocent in him, raising his face. Being late and then early, last in and first out, you're a fucking disgrace. Is that a fact now? Said the brother, winking an eye. He looked at the green stripe on your man's tie. God's truth, and let him strike me down for what I say, but I hate to be late twice on the one day. Going underground. He never worked in the mines, too delicate, his mother said. He should have been a priest. His hands never saw a day's dirt. He stayed in the place, watched the pit lorry come and go, sent his sister out to do the farm work and bring in coal. Called her a tipper when she was late. Some said he hit her. Put his feet up on the hob, warmed his slippers, ate his fill in every house. Lived to be a great age. At his funeral, one man said, wouldn't you love to throw a big lump of coal down in his coffin and hear the thump of it? No need, said another, no need. He'd burn without it. Again, out of that place, out of that landscape, you carry things for so long and you make things with them. But I made this character called Christy McGaddy, and he was made out of all kinds of things, my own imagination, my own experience, meeting a man, Dickie Reardon in Dublin, who told me that he knew Patrick Cavanagh very well in Dublin in the 50s, and he said that Cavanagh, when he was drunk, used to spit out with real invective and feeling, he'd say, Leitrim, where they never heard the name Jesus Christ till the 16th century. Mm-hmm. And I was very taken by that notion. And there was always something very pagan about where I was and the whole go of it and growing up. And I made this character, Christy McGaddy, whose life in some ways parallels the life of Christ, but completely differently. It's like an Irish country Christ, and the miracle is all of it athwart at the end. But it's too long to read all of it, but I'll read a bit of it to give you a flavour of it, which is also part of a flavour of place and language. The pronunciationer, Francie McGaddy, decides to wed. Do you know what I'm going to say to the Amazon? It's time I was getting a wife, a nice young one. I'm thinking it now while the time is coming, for there's as much food gone to waste in our house as would feed a woman. So he went and the match was made with a girl from Glan. She arrived with £100 and a frying pan. Her hair was as gold as the sun, her eyes were brown, and the best thing he said, she can't talk, so she'll not let me down. The assumption. She was very nearly assumed a year after she went, climbing the hills to the shop, still dressed like a bride. A fillet of wind from the south blew her up in the air. McMorrow below looked up from his work for a stare. He took in his fill of the lovely soft white of her thigh, and blessing himself said, I never knew virgins could fly. The Annunciation. A number of years then passed and not a stir. Francie heard the Hennigan's laugh. Was it him or her? He flew into a terrible rage and cursed their breed, went home to beat his wife and to eat a feed. His dinner was there on the pan and herself in bed. She spoke for the very first time, I think I'm near dead. The doctor came out the next day and went up in the room. As soon as he opened the door, the babe leaped in her womb. He went out to her man with the news he was pacing about. Your wife is pregnant, he said. McGann let a shout, ah, what kind of sickness is that? And why is it here when the Hennigan's down there below has a child every year? The birth. She was scraping manure on the dunghill when her waters broke. The donkey watched him arriving, a queer looking yoke. She cut the cord herself. The black cow licked him clean. His father opened the byre door. His lamp was the moon. The presentation in the chapel. They went to the chapel to have him christened Oliver Michael Mary. For the love of God, said the priest, give him a right name. Christopher James he'll be. In the name of the Father he poured the water. And what's your charge, said McGaddy, because I'm not made of money and I have a wife to support. Now, what you haven't. Christy got his baptism free. His first miracle was his best. He survived 3 years in the churn and 7 at his mother's breast. No swaddling clothes. Regarding the churn, it was a barrel, not a dash, and more convenient than a cradle, where you could fling in a shovel of ashes and not waste water washing nappies. So he grew taller as the ashes got higher, till his buttery yellow curls peeped out, and his two blue eyes gazed and gazed at all the wonders about, and his mother baking bread. Among school children, they made a donkey of him in the school yard. Hughie McGovern got up on his back. I'm Jesus, he said. You're the ass, and we're off to Jerusalem. Frankie McPadden took off his galluses and made a rope to lead him by the neck. The girls cut sally rods to beat him. One of them got a blackthorn stick as well. They led him 3 times around in a circle. If you tell, said Miriam Goldrick, if you tell, tomorrow we'll crucify you. The happiest day of his mother's life. He got a white suit from America for his first communion. It arrived in a parcel from his mother's brother in Connecticut with a white missile, white socks, white shoes, and a red rosette. His father said, no son of mine is going to wear white shoes, so they went into town and bought black ones. In the porch of the chapel, Hughie McGovern said all he was missing was a veil and gloves and pushed him in with the girls who pushed him back. Christy cried, even though he got 7 shillings, and Mrs. O'Donnell said he looked like an angel. He cried every Sunday after for 3 years, till his father put the suit out on a stick to keep the crows away from the turnips. About his business. When he left school, he worked on the farm, cut turf, saved hay, bushed gaps, set spuds, snagged turnips, put out manure. His father beat him, but only on a Friday. Once he ran away to the town, slept in a ditch for 2 nights. When his parents found him, he was in the fair green, surrounded by people all listening to him. They said he was the smartest lad ever came about, and he should be let out more often. The three of them went home and sat round the hob. His mother fed him currant cake. His father stared at him and said, to think that our boy could talk like that. Well, it's a friend. Then they were silent, and sat late into the night. The wedding feast. They all went up to a wedding in the next town land, and everything went with a swing, till the boys took hand of Christy and slipped him port wine. Mary McGuire took him out dancing, he couldn't keep time. That old band is very bad, very fast, he said. Can we sit down now? Can we sit down? I have a reeling in my head. They had a great laugh when he went off on him, green round the gills. His mother and father, the loon and scolding all the way down the hills. They wouldn't have laughed quite so hearty, but who could foretell that he'd turn the wine into water and piss in the well? And I'll finish, so it's not the end piece, with this. Years in the wilderness. The years went by slow and steady as a stream of treacle into a baking tin. Most of the people his age went away, the fools, his father said, the fools and everything they could want here under their nose. I suppose it's not good enough for them. They came back with girls and cigarettes, with cars and girls, and, sorry, they came back with cars and cigarettes, and it's hard to get those in order, with cars and cigarettes and girls with short skirts. His mother and father had a great laugh at the cousin. Miriam Goldrick came home from England with a black man and they went into town to see him. Christy went to the dances but spent most of the time with his arse stuck to the wall. He asked could he buy clothes and be like everyone else. His father gave him a clout. Clothes, he said, clothes isn't what you have on your clothes. You're doing too much gadding about, and it's not doing your head any good. He grew a beard, but his father said it made him look like the devil and shave it off to fuck. So he did. He took to wearing a big brown top coat summer and winter. The children would ask, did he sleep in them Wellingtons? And he'd flail at them with his ash plant. The years went by. The treacle dripped. His mother dropped a spoon on the floor and got into a state because that meant there was a visitor coming and not a thing in the house to offer them. He watched the cars on the road and memorised every number. He'd stand in the one spot all day and reel off names, makes, colours of cars and who owned them. He put a number plate on his bicycle, a bit of cardboard tied with string, IT1. Somebody stole it on him, and he never put it back. The mission came one November, and everyone said the Redemptorist was the peel picture of Christy. He bought a big brown rosary beads and two green scapulars, and prayed and prayed and prayed. He saw the Virgin Mary in a gap in his neighbour's land. He thought she was lovely, a bit like his own mother, only her scarf was straight and her hair, as far as he could make out, was black. He remarked on the shape of her nose. She didn't say a word, only looked at him. The neighbour wasn't a bit impressed. Fuck you, he said, that field is mine. Time dripped, dripped, dripped. A knife fell on the concrete floor. Christy couldn't keep time. I suppose, again, you know, it's always hard to think of what to read at any individual reading in any place, and at times you're drawn to particular memories and poems and people, and there's one person who I suppose has never really left me and never will, with this wonderful woman, Sharon, whom I fell in love with when I was a very young man. And two poems, she died when she was 24, and the second poem is about all of that. But the first poem goes back before then, to some of the best of you. Winter lust. Pissing in the snow, I managed ILO and half a straggling V. You leant, laughing, out of the window of your digs in Grosvenor Square. You're mad, you said. Pure mad. What about Mrs. Quinn? What if she comes out? She didn't, but I wish that I'd climbed in. And Homeric laughter, and after Sharon died, I wanted to write about her, and it took me about 20 years to write this poem, almost 20 years. And as is often the way, you carry something for so long, and one day I was looking up a reference to Homer, something completely separate, and this phrase, Homeric laughter, leapt out of me from a dictionary or a thesaurus, whatever it was, and meaning the laughter of the gods, or laughter from the gods. And it opened a door, and I wrote this in almost one go. Homeric laughter, that's what I heard, Sharon. 10 years after your death, your beautiful, clear, singing laughter, in my mind, in my dream, in me, it filled the day with bird light, with white hope. You tell me in the dream you're going to be married. You'll stand naked on your wedding dress for the ceremony. You laugh. We both laugh as we did when we were 19 and one louche Friday afternoon for a dare, remember, we went into a bridal shop, a posh one, on Stephen's Green, with Anne. You were the bride-to-be, you said. Anne was your bridesmaid. I was the groom. They looked me up and down. But I think they believed you, even when they asked, when is the wedding? And you named a date not a month off. I could see their polite eye masks, adding two and two and you and me and getting a baby on the way. Bride and bridesmaid paraded in white dresses, flouncy, tapered, taffeta. Barefoot, the two of you barefoot, twirling, tossing your hair, and we laughed and tried not to laugh, and the more we smothered it, the more the mirrors brimmed with laughter. I like this one, you say. What do you think? Does it suit my eyes? How much? Only 300, I take you. That was 5 years before you died. Do you remember that last day, how we meet by accident on Andrew Street? You're off to France that evening, and we spend the afternoon in pubs and cafes, drinking, talking, making love to life. You tell me about your Christmas at home and what was said. Your eyes fill up with tears, you smudge them half away. I walk you to the taxi rank on Aston Quay, and we kiss goodbye forever. 3 days later, you're dead on a railway platform near Montpellier. That fall from the barely moving train, that fall through time. A man watches your life leaving your eyes. I overhear the news on a number 7 bus. Where did it happen, young girl asks? In the south of France. They're bringing the body back next week. The body. I don't know how I knew it was you. How could I not know? And so, the snow-covered Midlands, the church with a dozen priests on the altar, one says, I remember when Sharon was a twinkle in her father's eye. The nuns from your school days, their calm excitement with her boyfriend in the south of France. Dennis is waiting in the snow by your grave. We hug and hold each other. You must meet, you said. Someday I know the two of you will meet. Your mother meets us at the door of their new house. Well, Anne, she says, a sad end to Sharon. I can't remember what we ate or drank. That night in Tullamore, I walk out on the frozen canal. I don't remember it till next day, watching the whitened landscape through the train window. Your dream when we were 19, after a few joints, the dream you laughed away, but I knew haunted you. I saw Jack Frost last night, you said, his sinister Jack Frost face looking in the window at me, and I saw you walking on water, like Jesus. It was the Jesus bit we'd laugh about for months after, but it wasn't funny, you said, it frightened you. And now they're here, these two images, you in your snow grave, me walking the canal water, those two images staring back at me, on a train, on a train, on a train, and you're gone, vanished out of life, and I can't tell you what I now know. The same year as the wedding dress, remember, we read The Dead in college. Snow is general over Ireland. 20 years ago. 20 years. I've never visited your grave. Someday I will. But I think of you every time I drive through that town. Every time I take the train south in France. Every snowfall. Every dreamless night, listening for laughter. The mirror is silent in my darkening room. And now for something completely different. And going back to a little bit of Leitrim and a lot of rural Ireland. And where I grew up, there were lots of bachelor men, and I always had a great affection for a lot of them. And I always felt that their lives are probably far more complex than and rich than most people presumed. And there's a book, and I talked about this in Waterloo, Paul Rose, you there last year, a book by a fantastic photograph by this American photographer, Jill Friedman, and now published in this volume called Ireland Ever. And many of the photos are from my part of Leitrim, and there are lots of bachelor men and miners. And what annoyed me in particular about them, even though they're great photographs taken in the 70s, is that none of the people are named. They're all presented as these anonymous figures in the landscape. And they're not anonymous, they're real, they lived, I knew most of them, some of them are still alive. And I've always felt very strongly that names are important, and acknowledgement of names, and acknowledgement of people's lives. And before I saw that book or those photos at all, I'd written a long screed, in a way, about some of that, and some of the bachelor men. And I'll read a little bit of that and a couple of the poems, and I'll finish with it. From a longer poem called A Refusal to Mourn or Bow to Cliché. It's about, again, this presentation of clichéd images of some of the bachelors of Ireland. This is not to say that no such men exist. I've often seen them swaying home, half pissed. I've watched them cry and slobber in their beer, but often too I've seen a light as clear and noble in their drunk or sober eyes as would set flame to love, or enterprise more active still, for who's to say what man or woman loved them in their day? Reduced to cliché, they can never be more than lazy minds and strangers see in pubs, in blotty books, in camera's eye, half-sodden fools whose lot in life to die. A man's ablution. Jim, James, Tom like to wash. Between mornings in the town, 5 pints and a few small ones, and the evening of drinking. He'd drive home on the tractor, fill the red base from the kettle, shave, splash a drop on his face, wipe it with a grey flannel, put on a clean shirt over the dirty vest, and sigh with contentment. It's no lie, he'd say, but there's nothing like a good wash to make you feel like a new man. The President. Jack Kelly got spruced up to meet the President. She was in town for the day to meet the people. He shaved, washed, put on his best suit and a tie. She fancied me, he'd say after. No doubt in it, sure she all would ask me out. There was a photo of them in the paper the week after. She never looked better. Unseasonal this, but nonetheless. Like most extraordinary things, based on truth. Christmas dinner. Johnny Joe was cooking the turkey, a frozen bruiser in a baby belly. He said to the neighbour, sure won't it thaw out with the heat? The only problem is she's too big and the door won't close. But I'll fix it, he said, and he got a lorry from the shed and he propped it to the door of the cooker. Sound job, only a bit of the arse sticking out, and you'd never mind that for a sight. I think, says he, the Pope's nose won't cook this side of the Christmas, but hurry is on you, stay for a bite. I've often thought that that the notion of Celtic spirituality is very restricted in its scope and leaves out a lot of the darker edges, and this is a very alternative form of it. Blessing. Paddy met a neighbour in the market bar. I hear, he said, our friend above has cancer of the spine. Cried to the neighbour, that's bad news. He'll not get long with that. Aye, said Paddy. I'm only after hearing it there now. He took a slug of fat. Aye, God speed the cunt. He'll not get long with that. Good Friday. When Pat Flynn choked on a fishbone in the men's toilet of the county hotel, Everyone thought he died of the drink. In a way, said his mother at the funeral, in a way, it's a small consolation. Anyway, that's what I think. Years ago, around the time of the strike in the mines, a couple of women from England came and showed some of the bachelor men that I've been writing about a good time in the hills around Tarman Rigna, and then disappeared off with a few bob, and I wouldn't say too many broken hearts, but it wasn't all a bad exchange. And years later, about 10 years ago, I remember reading about something similar, kind of mobile brothels through mail, and doesn't seem like maybe the worst thing, you know, mobile brothels. And this is a simple morality tale. The knocking shop came round and cleaned them out. Two ones from England, 40s, blonde and stout. They drove a white van and spoke very posh. You'll see a good time when we see your dosh. They drove the mountain roads and did good trade. Many a bachelor had his bed unmade, and many a voodoo vanished without trace in Joan and Jeannie's 86 IA. John Mick would boast he had the two together in broad daylight upon a bank of heather. They told him they were sisters, and he grinned, a bush in each hand and a bird between. The priest called up to Frank and Jimmy Joe to say they were a scandal and a show. That's as may be, father, said the men, but let him throw the stones that has no sin. Mr. Bailey from the bank stepped in as well and said the poor should be packed off to hell. They'll rob you blind, he told O'Brien one day. Just like yourself, said he, and walked away. They left without a word to soul or sinner, themselves and Anne, who cooked the old folks' dinner. I never knew she had it in her, said Maguire, but I'd sooner eat her sponge than stoke her fire. John Mick said, look about, it could be worse. What use is money if your transport is a hearse? We had our fun, we paid, there's no one dead, and praise the Lord for Joan and Jeannie's head. And I'll finish with a different, same sort of place, but again, perspective on what it means. Lunar landing. You all think, the barman said, you all think that Neil Armstrong was the first man on the moon. Well, you're wrong, because he wasn't. You see, Francie McPadden was going home this night and a good 14 or 15 pints in his belly. There was a full moon, it was July, and there's a four of a bend in the road out there by the cross. Francie took it in top, and it seems he was blinded by the moonlight, and the old Cortina went splash into the lake, right into the moon in the water. So you could say Francie landed well ahead of Armstrong, only he didn't come back.